Good evening. This is wonderful. Yeah. The essence of Bhakti and Bhakti Sutra. First, let me start with something which you may or may not be prepared to hear. Bhakti Yoga is the most simple, straightforward shortcut to attain life's purpose. At the same time, it is the most confusing, most convoluted among all paths. Bhakti Yoga, on one hand, has provided the human race with something extremely practical, and at the same time, it has done great damage to mankind too. The least understood and the most misunderstood among all paths, among all disciplines, is the Bhakti Yoga. So let me tell you why. Normally, Bhakti Yoga is associated with, quote, Bhakti, love and devotion. That's what the literal meaning of the word tells us. Bhakti means love and devotion. Yoga means yoga. The union of individual soul and the highest divinity is called Bhakti Yoga. Normally, it is always associated with Bhakti, love and devotion to a particular god, a particular goddess. And what we normally do not understand, that any god and any goddess who we focus our love and devotion to is as short-lived as we are. Any god and goddess that human beings ever came to know may be a little bit, they may have lived a little bit longer than the life of an individual, but no god or goddess ever lived here. Never remained the focal point of our love and devotion throughout the span of life of a society. And not to mention the life of the planet, life of this world. That's how short-lived are these gods and goddesses. There must have been a great deal of love and devotion which the people of Egypt must have focused to their Egyptian gods and goddesses. Today, none of those gods and goddesses are around. Along with the disappearance of those gods and goddesses, even the bhakti toward those gods and goddesses are also gone. But yet still, the human beings are still there in Egypt. Let's take an example of Greek gods and goddesses. Those Greek gods and goddesses are gone, and the people in Greece are still alive. They may be the same old Greeks, or they may have been replaced by somebody else. But as far as the human population in a country called Greek is concerned, it's still there. Their gods and the gods and god, those Greek gods and goddesses, and the love and devotion to those Greek and Greek gods and goddesses has gone done finished. And yet, we force ourselves to believe that all these gods and goddesses where we focus our love and devotion are eternal, immortal. And we focus our, we go on insisting that this is God. So that is one problem. It means the kind of gods and goddesses which are the focal point of our love and worship in bhakti yoga got to be a little bit more, you know, elevated gods and goddesses. Then other trait is that we worship these gods and goddesses while employing our cultural practices. And we think that those cultural practices, cultural elements that we employ to express our love and devotion are really, really the most authentic and real. And sometimes, just to prove, just to demonstrate, just to convince others that this is the way God to be worshipped and this is the way how we must express our love and devotion to God, and expressing our love and devotion to God in some different manner is absolutely, you know, useless or maybe even act of infidels. Okay. So in India, no matter how clean or dirty is the temple, you must take off your shoes before you enter the temple. No matter how cold it is, you must take off your shoes and socks. Okay. Now, you go to Tibet. You are asked to keep your shoes on. Okay. In India, or let's say the Indian religious practices, mainly the different divisions and subdivisions of Hinduism, there is a very standard procedure how you worship God, how you express your love and devotion to God. Number one, you wear certain kind of clothes. That is expected, to make you not just cleaner but even purer. Then you take bath. And bath is more of ritual nature rather than a functional thing. Then you do fasting. Fasting permits certain kind of food. Then there is a long, there is an elaborate ritual, there is a short ritual, and there is intermediate, length ritual. And those rituals consist of normally offering water, incense, sandalwood paste, little rice, little turmeric, yogurt, milk, ghee, honey, betel nuts, betel leaves, sweets, List can go on. It's called Panch Upchara Puja, Panchopachara Puja. The minimum, as a devotee of God, minimum you are expected to offer five, you are expected to do puja with five ingredients. Kal pancha means five, upchara means ingredients. Pancha upachara puja. Then, at least on auspicious occasions, such as full moon day, 11th day of the moon, new moon day, or sun, or let's say Sunday or Wednesday, Thursday, every different the gods have, those different gods have their favorite days, or the days are associated with those gods. So on those days, you offer elaborate rituals. You worship God with elaborate rituals. It's called Shodashopachara Puja, worshiping God with 16 different ingredients. Then in certain other puja, where offering a large variety of food to God occupies the central, is central to their puja worship. Call 64, the really elaborate one is 64 different dishes to be offered. You know, so there are unique concepts. You know, where again this, there are scriptures, quote scriptures, and every tradition has its own scripture and insists on, you know, considering that this particular book is the scripture. And the way things are described in this scripture is the way to worship God. So in that, some of those scriptures, 64 different dishes to be offered, scripture says, and that scripture I'm referring is belongs to, quote, Vaishnavism, Vishnu oriented, you know, school. Now, as it says, some gods, let's say Shiva is lover of tapas. Shiva is pleased through austerity. Vishnu is pleased when you offer food. So every god has his favorite way of being worshipped. Okay. So what I'm trying to tell you, that these are cultural things. In Japan, their sacred ritual centers around tea. Called, you know, tea ceremony. Their tea is very amazing tea. It's green, thick, foamy tea. And it's served in a small, you know, bowls, small cups. Extremely bitter. For a sweet lover like me, it's a torture. Okay. And a sweet loving culture like India, this is totally wrong to offer such a bitter tea to your god. You know, better you offer laddus. And for an American mind, my God, yuck, it's sweet ball. You know, it's unhealthy. It's better to offer chocolate. Now, even just in such a short, only in just a short period of time in the last 50 years, so much migration has taken place. So many people from India have immigrated to the United States and Europe. No. 70s, 80s, 90s has seen the greatest migration of people from Eastern, people from Asian countries to the Western countries. They have come with their values, including their religious values, their ways and methods of worship also. But already the third generation, have already started third generation of those Indians, Chinese, you know, Japanese, Koreans, Vietnamese, Filipinos have started, you know, growing here. First generation who came here, they have become grandparents. Their children were somewhat half there in India, psychologically, emotionally, and half in the United States. But children, they are 99%, you know, U.S. emotionally, you know, ideologically, they are 99% U.S. citizens, residents. And 1% is maybe still, you know, a Chinese, Indian, or Vietnamese, you know, spirit left in it, in them. And even that is confused spirit. In fact, there is a term. Since I'm from India, so I know the Indian jokes and Indian expressions more than Chinese and others. So there is a term called ABCD. You are 100% pure American, so you may not know. If you are 50% American and 50% Indian, you will get it, called ABCD. You know what does it stands for? American born, A, American, B, born, C, confused, D, Desis, means Indians. American born confused Indians. Their problem is, within the context of quote, let's say Bhakti Yoga, Krishna, Radha, Durga, Kali, Tara, Shiva, you know, should we worship God with our old laddus? And should does it need to be manufactured in India, or can we just buy chocolate? And still let's buy the best one imported from Belgium. Which one is better and why? Why one is more appropriate and why other is not? And the truth is, we don't have answer to it. Scriptures don't have answer to it. Because those so-called scriptures themselves are short-lived. When those books were written, perhaps chocolate did not exist. And this cross-cultural, this cultural pollination was not happening that fast in those days. Now when you think of this idea of bhakti yoga from this kind of mind, in this particular context, then you start realizing that there is a universal bhakti yoga and there is culturally confined bhakti yoga. Then you also start realizing that there is a short-lived God and there is very, very long-lived God. There is a God who is confined to a particular culture, society, and has adjusted itself to the contemporary cultural values. And there is a very, very pervasive and hopefully eternal, everlasting God who cannot be put in a box, any cultural box. And therefore, focusing our love and devotion to a God automatically first requires that we must understand which God are we talking about. Number one. Number two. We must understand why a particular conduit for expressing our love and devotion is more appropriate and why other is not. That is possible when you put yourself in several contexts. Of course, first you must put yourself in your personal context and see. Even the very, very first thing. Are you in need of any God? If no, then why? If yes, then why? Simple question. Now, in most of the, you know, traditions and sub-traditions that are closer to the idea of bhakti yoga, this question is not allowed to be entertained. Which God is? Whether you are in need of a God or you are not in need of God. If you are not in need of God, then your idea of focusing your love and devotion to God is totally, you know, kind of obsolete, cancelled. Only question remains in that case, should you or should you not care for, you know, channeling your love and devotion to anybody? If not to God, then at least, not, you know, if not to God, G-O-D, then what about to D-O-G? What is the virtue? Why do you love and care for dog? Is there any virtue in caring for your dog and cat? Is there any virtue in caring for your mom and dad? Is there any virtue in being concerned about anybody in life? If God is a very foreign concept and seems to be totally unnecessary, then the question is, still you are a human being. And as a human being, you are blessed with, you are infused with, you are endowed with thoughts, feelings, sentiments, emotions, and clearly there is a very natural tendency in all of us to have someone in life, share, discuss, give, receive. These are normal human tendencies. Question still remains that these tendencies are there. What to do with them? Whether you like to share those tendencies with others, whether you like to share those innate virtues with others, or you do not like to share, they are there. They do not seek your permission to be shared. We are doing it every day anyway. Is there any virtue in making a decision to have a focal point for our love and devotion? And should it be a conscious decision or just let it be the way it is, don't worry about it. And everybody has that virtue. Everybody is, you know, expressing their thoughts, feelings, sentiments, emotions, their ideas, their, you know, differences, lack of differences, you know, their opinions. There is always, you know, we write letters, we send greeting cards, we exchange gifts, we invite people at our home. When we feel invited by others, we feel good. When we are abandoned, it feels very bad. When we find ourselves accepted by others, it feels good. In some of us case, we automatically, without much, you know, attention to these facts, we just go on focusing our mental, emotional energies on certain things. We love watches. We love our dog. We love to drink. We love ice cream. We love parties. As in that, love for someone is not something we decide to do, it's just there. Is any virtue in making a decision that we should love somebody and force ourselves or forcibly cultivate, you know, kind of this samskara, cultivate this whole scenario that I have decided to love someone. And that's the person I'm going to. Normally it doesn't happen that way. There has to be some natural chemistry. Even when we go to, when we are looking for a puppy, we are looking for a watch, we are making a decision to buy an ice cream, there is always something in the back of our mind that helps us pick up a particular type of puppy. There's nothing like random selection. Either you love the height, face, or the size of the tail. You know, you have a great affinity for a dog as a pet to play with. Dog as a guard. Dog that prefers to be outdoors. Dog who is your hunting companion. Dog who is companion, you know, to go to bed with you. There is something very unique in you that enables you to make a decision. Why I should love this more than I should love anything else. Okay? The same very thing applies here. Some of us, we don't have much affinity to God. We don't know what it is. How can we love God when we do not know what it is? And the God or gods, goddess or goddesses whom we know are from a particular stock. How do we cultivate love for a God who is Christian God or Hindu God, Muslim God, Buddhist God, Egyptian God, God of old cultures which have vanished, and the God of tribal people? Let's say if you are born and raised in a particular religious background, we can see that there is a reason why our preference will be to worship that God. But on the same very note, there might be a very strong reason why not to worship that same very God. Sometimes we are so fed up. We have become rebellious. We are so fed up. A Hindu could be very good could be a very staunch worshipper of a Hindu God. But if some one screw goes loose, a Hindu can be the worst, you know, in terms of caring for that Hindu God. It's better to, you know, befriend a stranger than a God whom, for some reason, I began to hate. Okay? That's why conversion is very difficult to really appreciate. If the conversion takes place on the ground of some understanding and knowledge, it's lovely. Because you know exactly what you are getting to. But otherwise, if the conversion is due to your strong dislike to something, and that dislike of that dislike to something is the cause of liking something else, that does not really have much shakti in it. Sometimes that also happens. That's what, you know, that can happen in the realm of this religion too. And bhakti yoga is very, very, very closely associated with religion, because we are looking for a God. Now, how do we appreciate if for some reason, if we realize that bhakti yoga is something I should be trying? The thing is, how? Where? By doing what? Scriptures, or let's texts, and tell us. Sa prema swarupa. Sa means bhakti. I'm quoting from Bhakti Sutra of Narada. There are two major Bhakti Sutras. One is by Narada and one is by Shandilya. Shandilya. Bhakti Sutra of Shandilya is much bigger text, and Bhakti Sutra of Narada is smaller. For some reason, which I really don't know exactly why, Bhakti Sutra of Narada gained a greater popularity, at least in our modern times. And Bhakti Sutra of Shandilya is not that much known. But when you read the original text, both Narada's Bhakti Sutra and Shandilya's Bhakti Sutra, you get a very good understanding that Narada's Bhakti Sutra is really not that profound, not that structured, not that organized. And I don't remember how many sutras are there, probably maybe 70 or 100 at least. And out of hardly just 4 or 5 of them have any some profound meaning. And the rest of it is just praises, praises, praises. Those who are bhakti yogins, they are blessed. Wherever they live, the earth prospers, flowers blossom, and things goes on. You know, wherever out of love, where the drops of the tear, you know, their tears drop. You know, the whole earth is sanctified. You know, it just goes on. Those are sutra. Actually, it is sutra itself is telling. So that's how the majority of the sutra is. You know, upon finding this kind of love and bhakti, upon embracing this bhakti, then puman labdha matto bhavati, just exhilarated. Stabdho bhavati, he just becomes frozen. I don't know what it means exactly. I'm giving literal translation. Atma ramo bhavati, he just absolutely content. Exactly what it is, how does it work, is not much described in the Bhakti Sutra of Narada. Except, again, here, there, that there is higher bhakti and there is lower bhakti. Just as in the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, there is a higher samadhi and there is a lower samadhi. Similarly, here in Bhakti Sutra, there is higher bhakti and there is a lower bhakti. Higher bhakti is anirvachaniya swarupa. It is indescribable. Mukha swadhanvat. Just as mute person who cannot speak eats some very scrumptious, tasty food, different, you know, dish, and tries to explain how it tastes, and fails explaining it because he cannot speak. Similarly, the experience of this bhakti is just like the experience expressed by the experience of tasty food expressed by a mute person. Just goes on describing. However, the lower bhakti, in some places, the Ramayana of Tulsidasa, it's ninefold. In Narada's Bhakti Sutra, it's 11-fold. And this different, this 9-fold, 11-fold bhakti is based on your attitude toward the focal point of your love and devotion. That is God. How do you... on what ground do you embrace God? God as a master, and you yourself a servant, slave. God as a friend. God as a husband. And I have not heard much about, I have not read that God as a wife also. But God as a husband. You worship God as a husband. And Dainyabhav, you worship God with sense of lowness, that you are lower. Dainyam, in fact, even more than that, it's with sense of being helpless, powerless, desperate. No? And that carries a feeling of inferiority, dainya, mai din dukhi gaya gujra, I'm a person who is absolutely useless, worthless, has no direction, is totally lost, and God is completely opposite to that. So these are different grounds that are created, that are described. And on those different grounds, you connect yourself to God. The whole idea is that you are connecting yourself to God by establishing some kind of relationship. In our worldly relationship, there are two parties. And there is an understanding that there is an acceptance of each other in that relationship. Here, you extend relationship from your side and trust that the kind of relationship you are expecting from the other side, that is God, is already there. And don't let that faith, that trust, be ever challenged by your mind or by anybody else. If that happens, If somebody challenges it, then better tyagaha. You abandon that person. This is what even books are telling us. And this is why I'm telling you that this is, on one hand, every single religion, every single spiritual discipline, even if it's not what you call fully on the same very page as that of bhakti yoga, still it includes the elements of bhakti. The Yoga Sutra of Patanjali is loaded with the bhakti element. Christianity is loaded with bhakti element. No? Any religious spiritual tradition you can think of, there is no spiritual tradition which does not have bhakti element. No? And yet, everybody is talking about establishing a relationship. In Christianity, when you become nun, you are wedded to Jesus Christ. You made a decision, and you are very happy about that decision. You feel very blessed that you did it. But what about Jesus Christ? Has he given his consent to marry you too? Marry you? At that point, you are asked not to let that thought even come in your mind. You have been accepted. That's it. If you seek evidence, proof, you lost it. This kind of thought, and exactly Bhakti Sutra is telling the same thing. Anukulyasya sankalpaha pratukulyasya varjanam. When such thoughts come, immediately block it. Pratukulyasya varjanam, because it takes away that spiritually binding and spiritually illuminating nature of your loving relationship with God. Even if you allow the thought, question, am I being accepted, or it is just I'm just blindly, you know, all the time running around, you know, for last 10 years, 20 years, for my whole life, I'm just going to tell, my life is for Jesus Christ. You know, is he your employer? Is he your lover? Is he your father? Is he your mother? No matter who you call he is. How do you know that he cares for you? I understand that there is a mystical element in it. On one hand, Jesus Christ, Buddha, you know, Buddhists say, Buddham saranam gacchami. Excuse me. I take refuge in Buddha. How do you take refuge in somebody who died 2500 years ago? Okay. But this question is completely... This question is very, very damaging to the faith that you are trying to cultivate. Jesus Christ left this planet, this earth, 2000 years ago. Krishna left so long ago that today when we don't even, lots of people even have a hard time, accepting that he ever was born and ever lived on the earth. And even if he did, many, many thousand years ago, 5,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago, so this is just a matter of dispute, it's still going on. Has Krishna, Christ, Buddha, have any reciprocated your relationship? What proof do you have? You are looking for proof. You don't deserve to be a bhakta. you know, you don't deserve to be on the path of love and devotion. Is it correct? Is it something that's how it should be? Is it something our rational mind is going to accept? And if it does not, are we willing to throw aside our rational mind? Is throwing away, abandoning our rational mind, is part of or is not part of practicing bhakti yoga? And is it possible, is it within our capacity to just throw away, abandon, renounce our rational mind? No. So ankulyasya sankalpah pratikulyasya varjanam. When such thoughts come, such questions arise, then you immediately, you stop it, block it, and ankulyasya sankalpah, and immediately go back to your prescribed way of thinking, contemplating, talking, you know, reflecting, which is conducive to what you have decided to love, whom you have decided to love, and how you have decided to love. Okay? That is a sutra, right there. And regarding your other fellow beings, if your wife, husband, children, brother, sister, family, society, culture is somewhat talking and behaving in a manner, talking to you and behaving in a manner that it really contaminates the kind of love you have decided to have for your particular God, then quite often we are advised that just shun, completely abandon that family, society, and vivikta sthanam seveta. Go to a place where nobody has any chance to bother you anymore. Well, isn't that? That's what extremism is all about. You know? Is bhakti yoga is extremist path where you must stick to the idea that my way is the way, my path is the path, my God is the God, my Guru is the Guru, my way of worship is the only way. No. And this is what has been happened. This is what has happened in most of the traditions. Those who placed somewhat a greater emphasis on the bhakti element of their practice. So what I want to share with you is that bhakti yoga is much, much, much more than what we just mentioned, what we just shared. What is this? Now let's go back to a large set of texts and the teachings of saints and sages, the masters. And we begin with a realization, or let's say we begin with an understanding that there are good gurus and there are bad gurus. There are good books and there are not so good books. The things that are written there, some of them are absolutely correct and some of them are not correct. And we have to figure out a way of distinguishing what is right and what is not right, what is correct, what is not correct. Andha bhakti, blind bhakti, blind faith, blind love, and blind devotion leads us nowhere. It has to be grounded. Bhakti is something in part. It's already there in you because you are a human being. Loving, sharing, caring for others is your intrinsic virtue. It's already there. So in part, it's there. But it's not fully manifest. And it's not absolutely pure either. In our all these different forms of love that we find in our life, you can clearly see there is an element of selfishness. Okay? Even in our relationship, there is some degree of selfishness, some degree of impurity. And even if there is not such impurity in the relationship, then the conduit that we use, the speech that we use to express our love, you know, exchange our love with each other, that itself is contaminated to a great extent. A mind that is affected by avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, and avinivesha cannot be fully trusted. Mind that is affected by avidya, ignorance, asmita, distorted self-identity, raga, attachment, dvesha, aversion, dislike, and avinivesha, fear. Mind that is affected by these afflictions cannot be fully trusted. When and where and how this mind is going to change its, you know, shape and color, we never know. Therefore, every worldly relationship has some problem. So, we have to understand this thing, that this element of love is there. It is not fully manifest. And whatever little it is available to us in its manifest form is not absolutely pure and pristine. It is with that kind of love we are trying to be a lover. We are trying to find our beloved. So what it means? We have to bring the elements of purification into this love. Do something about this love which is not so pure, which is not flowing through the purest conduit. Without that, we are bound to keep, you know, switching from one church to another church, from one temple to another temple, from one relationship to another relationship, from one God to another God. And we keep shifting from one type of style of puja to another puja style. And in the process, when we get tired and confused, then we have to keep correcting ourselves, and we have to find a way of then, you know, somehow cultivating love for all paths lead to the same very place. If that is the truth, then catch hold of one person, one God, one Guru, done, finished. Why are you worried about all these things? You know? Then what are you trying to assess? What are you trying to evaluate? What are you trying to examine? And what are you trying to find from that? And what you are trying to find and making sure from that examination? What are you trying to conclude from that examination? The truth is that we are still somewhere at our human level where love, lust, no, fear and respect, all intermingled. And we need to go through a process of purification in order to capture that very essence of true love, true bhakti, true devotion, which we can invest into establishing a good, healthy relationship between ourselves and our beloved. So it's not just mindless decision that we one day make and force ourselves to stick to it. In part, it is very spontaneous, natural process, and in part, it is our decision, and it is our decision to cultivate a loving relationship. These go together. The more spontaneous, question-free, doubt-free, fear-free is our love, and more spontaneously acceptable is our God, the more we are toward, quote, higher form of bhakti. The more we are closer to worshipping God on a trial basis, the more we are closer to the lower form of bhakti. Because in this bhakti, there are lots of still unanswered questions. And there is lots of room for trial and errors. And we have to be prepared to use our rational mind. And we have to prepare ourselves to follow the disciplinary path prescribed by experienced people, experienced masters. We have to be humble, at the same time, mindful. We have to be simple, at the same time, we have to be questioning. Tadviddhi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya. We have to be humble. We have to tell ourselves that our knowledge is limited. We don't know much. With that attitude, we have to ask question. We have to ask question to ourselves. We have to ask questions to our teachers, and we have to ask questions to look for those questions and their answers in the scriptures. Pariprasnena. And sevaya. And there is something great about service. We have to be prepared to offer ourselves in the service of those from whom we are expecting some clarification on this path. Today we have luxury of logging on, signing for a course, digital course on bhakti yoga, and for all we need is just give our credit card number. But there have been times in our society, in our culture, when the credit card did not work. And when it didn't exist. And even currency did not exist. And we used to trade services. So you go and serve, offer your services at a very, very mundane level, interpretation of service. But the much more deeper interpretation of service, which is an element of, which is a component of finding the right path, understanding the right way, and gathering the element of love and devotion and applying it to our daily life is seva, that you serve. I have to be very, very committed to the Yoga Sutra in order to write the book on the Yoga Sutra and teach Yoga Sutra. That commitment is called service. That service supersedes all other duties of mine. I make a conscious decision to do so. And at some point, at its maturity, this decision becomes extremely spontaneous and effortless, and it's self-driven. So I wake up someday, 3 in the morning, and then suddenly I realize, oh my God, my 2 cups of chai is gone, and it's already 6 o'clock. I have to now rush, and still, while I'm rushing, still I want to read one more sentence and jot down the ideas before they disappear, before Deborah comes. I have to jot it down. This is called service to the Yoga Sutra, service to Patanjali, service to my tradition, service to my path. That is how I will get that knowledge and understanding that will clarify what is bhakti, and that will nurture my bhakti. This is something very natural. A physicist is very devoted to his physics. A medical student is devoted to his medical studies. That's why one person becomes a physicist, another becomes a doctor. How committed are gamblers? How committed are robbers and criminals and hackers to their profession, to their job? They are in the service of hacking. No. Cracking your codes. They are in the service of, collecting guns and drugs. They become good at it. Because they are fully in the service of that trade. Similarly, although it is very common sense, but somehow it is common sense that you are committed to the study of bhakti related texts. You are committed to contemplating on those elements. You are committed to interacting with similar minded people. And definitely one day you will become expert. It's a no-brainer. It's a very common sense. And yet, there is a bizarre expectation of spirituality which doesn't exist in other fields. And what is that? Through the grace of God and with the blessings of the teachers, it will happen to me. No. I have faith in my guru. A physicist doesn't say that. I have faith in my professor, and therefore I don't need to study. I'm enrolled, in Harvard and Stanford, and therefore I don't need to study. But in the spiritual realm, this is very bizarre. I've joined this group, and therefore I don't need to do anything anymore. Done. I follow Yogananda, I follow Jesus Christ. Mister, you have not even seen the footprints of Jesus Christ. who have not even gotten any idea whose trail he walked. You have no idea how he sat and how he stood and how he, spoke. And yet you are saying that you follow Jesus Christ and things will be just fine. And the basic thing is, unlike in other fields of study and learning, in this particular field, we are encouraged to do so. सब सौंप दिया क्या है तेरे हाथों में वेरी पीपल डू दिस कॉल्ड चैंटिंग आई हैव जस्ट सरेंडर्ड माई सेल्फ आई हैव जस्ट पुट माई सेल्फ एट योर फीट नाउ ओ लॉर्ड आई डोंट नीड टू डू एनीथिंग एनी मोर दिस इज कॉल्ड प्रेयर नो अदर फील्ड पीपल इन नो अदर फील्ड जस्ट सिट डाउन एंड स्टार्ट प्रेइंग I have surrendered myself to you, O Albert Einstein. Now I do not need to know anything. My life is in your hand, and knowledge will pour into my head. No? Because the wisdom of your physics has the bomb, it's like a bomb has exploded into my head, and now therefore I can create any kind of nuclear weapon I want because you are me and you are in me and I in you. Nobody does that. But in this particular field, we are supposed to sing this, we are supposed to compose these kinds of poetries and sing. And singing those poetry is called bhakti. See here, with a calm and tranquil mind. Think with a calm and tranquil mind and think with a mind which is not accompanied by a blind faith or nor is accompanied by baseless skepticism. But rather somewhere in between. Then conclude yourself by thinking that knowledge, with the help of that knowledge, with the help of that mind, then you conclude what is really missing here. Why somewhere we are allowed to walk while keeping our eyes opened? No, why somewhere in other some areas of our life we are expected to, we are advised to walk with our eyes opened? And why in this particular field we are advised to walk with our eyes closed? Isn't that there is something wrong? Something is really, really wrong. And unfortunately, considering walking with the eyes closed in the field of religion and spirituality is not supposed to be wrong. Rather, it is supposed to be right. And that is where a subject like bhakti becomes extremely confusing and misleading. Then the question is, what is here that we must understand and use it as a launching pad for comprehending, embracing bhakti yoga? I'll say it is understanding of higher divinity and its relationship with us and its relationship with the external world. And its simultaneous, its nature of simultaneous transcendence as well as being very personal. It's simultaneously, it is absolutely transcendent and it's extremely practical. Understanding the nature of that divinity, which is in the same very time, in the same very place, both transcendent as well as personal, which is immortal and eternal and yet kind enough, humble enough to live with mortal and non-eternal person. The divinity which is bigger than the entire universe and yet that which is smaller than the smallest particle that is known in me, smaller than me. Not just bigger than me, but rather it is bigger than the whole universe and yet it is smaller than me so that it can fit in me. How is that possible? And how does it happen? And how that relationship, how the relationship between that divinity and me is something extremely natural? And how by recognizing, discovering that relationship, actually we are just simply reaching to our most natural state of understanding, living and being is the foundation for bhakti yoga. In fact, not knowing what that divinity is, which continues infusing the life of mortals with immortality, is something absolutely natural to all of us. Not knowing that reality means we have somehow fallen from our natural state of understanding, living and being. And as soon as we comprehend it, bhakti is the most natural, spontaneous, effortless path of finding life's purpose. That will be subject matter of the next time. Thank you. God bless you. Good. It's okay? I was...